And the waters prevailed more and more upon the earth, so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered. The water prevailed 15 cubits. And if a cubit is 18 inches long, that's 22 and a half feet higher, and the mountains were covered. Doesn't that sound like a global flood? What did Jesus say? What did Jesus believe about a global flood? Well, in Matthew 24, 37 to 39, he says, "But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." See, Jesus is coming back. We know that. And he's comparing the flood of Noah's day with his coming back as an analogy or a comparison. "For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage," in other words, business as usual, not paying attention to the signs of the time, "until the day that Noah entered into the ark. And they knew not until the flood came and took just a few of them away in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley in the local flood." No, took them all away, probably billions of people living before the flood. "So shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." Now Jesus believed in a real Noah, a real ark, and the flood came and took them all away. And if that isn't enough to convince you that Jesus believed in a universal flood, it says in Revelations 1:7 that when he comes back, all eyes shall see him. So it's a global coming back all around the world. He's not going to compare a local flood to a global coming, is he? He's obviously going to use an example of a global flood to a global coming back. So this is even more evidence that Jesus believed in a global flood. And if Jesus believed in a global flood, I'm certainly going to believe in a global flood also. Who am I to question this and make up or believe this idea of a local flood? So it's a global flood. So you can go into it, into what it says in Scripture, 371-day flood, and you can diagram the phases and stages of it. Like this is from Taz Walker from Creation Ministries International in Australia. And you can compare it to a flash flood. So it has two stages. I'm using different terminology than Taz. Anyway, there's a flooding stage where it floods the earth. The earth is finally flooded at day 150. It covers the whole earth. And finally, the ark grounds on day 150. Then for the next 221 days, the land is exposed more and more as the waters are running off. And the way this works is the land comes up and the ocean basins sink and the water runs off at high speeds. I'll be talking more about this tomorrow. This is my talk tomorrow. Evidence of the high-speed runoff of the floodwaters off the land as the continents were emerging from the floodwaters. Today, I'm going to focus mainly on the flooding stage, this part right here, because this is where I think practically all the sedimentary rocks and practically all the fossils were generated in this period right here. So I'm going to be talking about sedimentary rocks and fossils. Tomorrow, I'll be talking about retreating stage, water moving as a sheet to start with. A sheet means it's wide and thin. It has a, if you looked at it going downstream, it'd be as thin as a sheet and wide and thin as a sheet. Maybe 1,000 miles wide and 2 miles deep. And if you diagram that on a piece of paper, it'd be like a sheet. And then as more mountains and plateaus emerge from the floodwaters are forced to channel around these. And then you change from sheet flow to more channelized flow. That's when the deep valleys and canyons and Grand Canyon were carved during that stage, by the way. The last phase of the flood. I believe that some people think that the flood peaked at day 40, but I don't go along with that for the simple reason that the mechanisms of the flood, which you can read in Genesis, the fountains of the great deep burst forth and the windows of heaven were open. They didn't shut off until day 150. But just like a flash flood, it'll probably rise fast. And by the way, the reason this is curved like this is because sea level is going to go up and down like a yo-yo. It'll be going up on the average, but it'll be oscillating a lot. Why? Because there's tides going on. There's a lot of tectonics. There's tsunamis. So there's lots of reasons for sea level to oscillate tremendously as it's gradually going up. So the flood peaks at day 150, and then it runs off till day 371. It's important to know that when it was running off, it was eroding the continents. The continents are tremendously eroded. I've done several calculations. I will give you some of these calculations of the amount of erosion on the continents. But what this means is that at day 150, the sediments, or sedimentary rocks, that's sediments that are turned to rock by adding cement to it, were probably up to here. And then as the continents were rising up out of the floodwaters, it was eroding, tremendously eroding, and it eroded this all off. And all that material now forms the continental shelf and slope and rise. And this is the present continental surface. And of course, that's where you find dinosaurs, right near the surface. They're probably all down in here too, but this illustration was made for a dinosaur book that will be out here that I'm publishing in about 2 months, called Dinosaur Mysteries and Challenges. And it focuses mainly on dinosaur tracks, eggs, and scavenged bone beds early in the flood. This is the hard data of dinosaurs that I'm dealing with. Okay, let's get into the five parts. That was just the introduction. This will be an hour long, by the way. Evidence from flood traditions. You know, it is amazing that you go to every culture in the whole world, and in their folklore, or whatever you call it, they have stories of huge floods, global floods, early. And when you compare those stories to what the flood, you find out some amazing similarities. And by the way, we're talking about hundreds of these. I think one publication I read in Creation magazine said there's about 500 of them. But you can see here, full representation of biblical idea is a green square. Partial representation is that red triangle. You can see when you compare, here's the events of the flood right down here. You know, like Hawaii, you know, they hit some right on. And of course, the closer you get to the Middle East, actually, the more they hit. And of course, some theologian has to say, well, maybe the Epic of Gilgamesh, which one of these represents, is probably the original and just Noah copied it. Well, okay, let's think about that for a minute. The boat in the Epic of Gilgamesh is 120 feet. By 120 feet by 120 feet. So what is a cube going to do in rough seas? It's going to go like this. While the shape of the boat in the Bible is a length to width ratio of 6 to 1, very similar to the length to width ratio of modern ships and barges. So the account in the Bible makes much more sense. So obviously that is the original and not the Epic of Gilgamesh. But the point of all this, even though the stories are greatly distorted, is that there's some truth to it. It's like the telephone game where you call someone up and tell them a story, and he's supposed to call someone up and so on. And after maybe 7 times, that person calls the original person, and then they compare. Are they ever identical? No, they're distorted. And, you know, that makes sense. As people spread out from the Tower of Babel, they're going to remember this global flood. But they're going to distort it. But the fact that it's in their culture indicates that back then it's very likely, it's just a strong circumstantial evidence that there was really a global flood at the beginning of when this culture started. Evidence from strata or sedimentary rocks. This is general for the whole world, but the best place to see a slice of sedimentary rocks is Grand Canyon. There's 3 things to note when you see Grand Canyon. You have 4,000 feet of sedimentary rocks. They're all flat-lying, one on top of another, with little or no erosion at the between the layers and within the layers. Also, there's a flat surface at the top. And there's evidence that you have eroded almost 10,000 feet of sedimentary rocks above that just to get down to where the top of Grand Canyon is. I'll talk about that soon. Also, some of these formations, like this, the Coconino Sandstone, you can trace that clear through the Grand Canyon for 200 miles and a lot further east. And there's another formation down here called the Tapete Sandstone, right in here, that you can trace over much of North America. I'll get to this in a second. But what the Grand Canyon evidence, the planation surface, sedimentary rocks are regional or continental scale, and there's no erosion between the rocks. So I'm going to flesh all that out. That's what that erosion surface looks like on the top. I'll be talking more about erosion and planation surfaces tomorrow, where you took off thousands of feet of sedimentary rocks and planed it flat. We do not observe this happening today. Present processes do not form flat surfaces in hard rock. They cut canyons and rills and coulees, this sort of thing. They do not form flat surfaces. This is the North Rim. Grand Canyon's right there, but look how flat it is up there. And evidence that of the strata that was once on top of that area, you go to the Grand Staircase to the north. You have 10,000 feet of sedimentary rock right in there. And here's a diagram of it. It's 5-to-1 vertical exaggeration. Here's Grand Canyon about right here. All this sedimentary rock was up over Grand Canyon before Grand Canyon was even carved. Just a little bit of the evidence of the tremendous erosion. But let's get to, I'm going to talk more about that tomorrow, so I'm not going to say anything more about planation surfaces. They're not forming today. Present processes do not form them, but the flood can easily form them. Stay tuned tomorrow till 11:20. Anyway, this is the Tapete sandstone. It's about 200, 300 feet thick in the Grand Canyon, and it's mostly coarse grain. In fact, it has little pebbles of quartz through it, and, you know, little cross beds. And then above it, you have the Bright Angel Shale, and in that green shale, you have all these what are considered worm burrows. It's possible they could be fluid escape structures, but I'll lean in that they're worm burrows because they do look like them. Oops. See it right in there. Now, I can go up into Wyoming and Montana and see the same identical layers on top of basement rocks, as we call them. Sandstone, and then the green shale, and then above that are carbonates. The same sequence as you see in the Grand Canyon, I have verified in Wyoming and Montana. They're given different names because different geologists did the work. And this is one of them near Cody, Wyoming. It's called the Flathead Sandstone. And there's your quartz pebbles, coarse grained. This is just west of Cody, Wyoming. And then west of Great Falls, Montana, in the Rocky Mountains, above the Flathead Sandstone, you have this green shale that's got these worm burrows in it. Look at that. And then you have carbonates, same sequence. Andrew Snelling says that you can not only verify it from northern Arizona and Grand Canyon up to Montana and Wyoming, but it goes up into northern Canada, and in the subsurface it goes in the Midwest and clear to the Appalachian basins to the Blue Ridge Mountains. What does this mean? Now, if you're thinking about present processes, what kind of present processes are going to deposit a sand layer about 200 or 300 feet thick over a region like that? And then the next formation being a green shale on top of it over that region, and then carbonates from up there. This is continental scale sedimentation. This is what you expect with Noah's flood. Big, huge process of erosion and then big currents and deposition. But present processes are formed little, small-scale sedimentation. And when you look at that sedimentation, a lot of times it's a sand layer, but it changes to a clay layer, changes to a gravel layer, both vertically and horizontally, changes rapidly. That's what you see in sedimentation today. In present processes is what they need to explain this, and they can't. And this is not unusual. You go to the Coconino Sandstone above that, near the top of the Grand Canyon. Right here, it's about 200, 300 feet thick. You can trace that from Grand Canyon. This is the thickness of it. All throughout in here, it's given different names. It's the Glorieta Formation in New Mexico. But again, this is not as large as the Tapetes, but it's still substantial, much greater than present processes can produce. And then you've got a layer on the Colorado Plateau, an area of about 150,000 square miles of the Shinnerup conglomerate. It's about 50 feet of pebbles and small rocks. I think the largest one's up to about 5 inches. This is spread evenly over much of the Colorado Plateau, but it's been eroded a lot. Remember I said there's a lot of continental erosion? Well, it's eroded, so you only see it here and there. I've seen it in about a dozen places, and you can connect the dots, and it generally covers most of the Colorado Plateau, which is this area right here. About 150,000 square miles. Now, what sort of present processes are going to spread a layer of gravel over 150,000 square miles, fairly even thickness of 50 feet? There's no such thing. These are large-scale, regional-scale floods that'll do this. This is evidence of Noah's flood. And by the way, I'm not just picking up isolated examples. It's just that I've been studying the geology of the western U.S. a lot. But it's similar to other places in the world. This is not unusual. Now, when we look at erosion over a million-year time scale, all continents can be eroded down, all the mountains down to sea level in 10 million years at today's rate. At today's rate, there's a caveat. You've got to adjust today's rate. So you're going to shade this 10 million years a little to longer periods. If you include man causes some of that erosion, they think about half. So you'd have to up that to 20 million years if you took out man's part. Also, as erosion whittles the mountains down, the erosion rate decreases, so it takes longer to erode from hills down to a flatter surface. But it does not include coastal erosion. This erosion is just determined by mud taken out by rivers. They measure the amount of mud taken out by rivers, and then they deduce how much erosion is occurring on continents. They do not include coastal erosion, which is very heavy on the Arctic coast, about an average of 21 feet a year. And that would, make it faster. But I'm going to just simply put a max. Others have put a max of 33 million years. I'll just say 50 million years as a maximum amount of time to level North America down flat to sea level. Well, what is this telling us? Well, it's telling us that erosion's so fast that we should see huge amounts of erosion in any set of sedimentary rocks that are millions of years old. For instance, in the Grand Canyon. Just in a million years, this is what should happen. This is basement rock, granites, that sort of thing. And here you suddenly laid down 4 sedimentary layers. Give it a little more some time, and erosion occurs. Valleys occur, rivers, streams. And this is what you see after a short period of time, maybe 100,000 years. Then it drops below the sea level, and you have more sedimentation. And you add another 4 layers, this is what should happen. Then it should occur on and on for about a million years. After a million years, this is what you should see in a cliff. Tremendous erosion. This is just, I'm just guessing, a million years. Remember, Grand Canyon is 300 million year sequence, they claim. So this is what you see. The layers are generally flat and even over all the Grand Canyon. Sometimes there's a thin layer and they thicken with time. So that's what you see. So you don't see anything like this at all, which is telling us that 300 million years doesn't exist. And it's strong evidence for the flood, because we'd expect in the flood one layer laid down over wide areas, one on top of another with little time for erosion. This is exactly what we expect for the flood. We have tremendous evidence in the sedimentary rocks for the flood. But to back this up a little more, I'm going to go to the same sequence in the bottom two-thirds of the Grand Canyon up into the Grand Teton Mountains. The Grand Tetons are granites up in the middle, and on the sides are sedimentary rocks that have been uplifted. And here, this is the Southern Teton Mountains. And here's some of there's the Flathead Sandstone. And other layers. This is equivalent to the Redwall Formation in the Grand Canyon. But it's the same thing. There's no erosion at those boundaries there in these sequences. No erosion. And this was admitted by 3 geologists. David Love and 2 others in the book Geological Chronicle of Jackson Hole in the Teton Range said The regularity and parallelism of the layers in well-exposed sections, which I just showed you, suggests that all these rocks were deposited in a single uninterrupted sequence. Oh, do we have something like that in our history? It's called the Genesis flood. But do they believe their eyes, their observational skills? It's because of their biases. However, the fossils and regional distribution of the rock units suggest that this is not really the case. The incomplete nature of the stratigraphic record becomes apparent when the spans of time represented by each of the various formations are plotted on a numerical time scale. And here's their time scale right here. This is in millions of years right here, 500, 400, 300. And this is the Flathead Sandstone at the bottom right here. And these three formations. And then you have that, and then that, and that. Most of it is empty space. There's 80 million years of missing time between those two formations. Well, if that's the case, and you can erode all of North America down within 50 million years, where's all the evidence of erosion in these sedimentary layers? Now, this is not unusual. This is typical worldwide. Sedimentary layers, no erosion, implies that they're deposited rapidly and over wide areas, continental scale sometimes, regional scale. This is powerful evidence for Noah's flood, right in the sedimentary rocks. Now, this evidence isn't hidden in a corner. This is basic, big picture, sedimentary rocks. Powerful evidence for the reality of Noah's flood. Number three, evidence from fossils. How do you form a fossil? Well, first of all, it's not going to sit around on the surface of the ground and wait to be fossilized. Something's got to happen. I mean, you got to bury it rapidly. That's the number one condition. It's got to be buried rapidly. You know, so if it's sitting there in the soil, there's acids that move through the soil. Basic rocks are going to eat the bones out of the shells within a very short time. So to form a fossil, that organism buried, you must force chemicals into the hard parts. The soft parts will rot real quick. But you have to force chemicals under high pressure into the bones or for petrified wood. So that's a big problem. In fact, fossilization is a very big problem, as well as cementation to the uniformitarian paradigm. Because you don't have enough chemicals in the groundwater to form that many fossils today. That's why fossilization's rare. It happens, but it's pretty rare. And yet, we have trillions of fossils out there. Trillions. Some of them huge dinosaurs. Some big dinosaur graveyards. 10,000 dinosaurs packed into a 3-foot-thick layer, 1.5 miles long, and about 1.25 miles wide. That's a bone bed in Montana. 10,000 duckbill dinosaurs. It's an underestimate. I mean, does this sound like normal business of flash floods? No, it doesn't. You have to bury it rapidly and force those chemicals into it to turn it to stone. And just like I said with the dinosaur graveyards, there's lots of other graveyards. It seems to me that you do find organisms or fossils in isolation, but commonly you find them together. I can search all day for fossils in the Rocky Mountain front, and I don't find any, or maybe find one or two, and suddenly I come to a place where there's lots of them. This is a graveyard of ammonites from Venezuela. Also, we have some tremendous fossils that are preserved, so well preserved that the idea of slow processes over millions of years just doesn't make any sense. Like, here's a jellyfish. Here's a fossil. Oops. Wrong button. Anyway, and it fossilized jellyfish, and it looks identical to jellyfish today. And look at the age they claim this thing is. 505 million years old, as reported in Creation magazine. Very interesting. And we have a lot of these, fish-eating fish, but couldn't swallow its dinner before it was buried and then fossilized. And this is my, here's another one where it didn't even digest. And here's my favorite one, Mother Ichthyosaur. Ichthyosaur is a marine reptile. In fact, they found one of these up in northern Canada just recently. I think that was 60 feet long. Generally, they're short. They're only about 6 to 10 feet. But anyway, that's not an extra tale. It was fossilized at the point of giving birth, buried and fossilized. Also, 95% of fossils are marine organisms, mostly mollusks, which are shelled organisms. Most mollusks, when you find them in the rocks, are closed-shelled. All over the earth. I have some from Sweden. I have some from Montana. And today, where you see the bottoms of lakes and at the bottom of the ocean where these mollusks live today, like clams, you hardly find, not only do you not find any closed dead ones, you do not hardly find any open shells or shells. They disintegrate so fast. A shell, when a mollusk dies, the muscles weaken and detach, and within a matter of hours to days, it opens up. Hours to days, it opens up. And then within a matter of months, the organic matter holding the shell together, it's organic and inorganic, the organic matter rots and the shell just disintegrates just like that. And this is admitted in the principles of paleontology. As soon as an oyster or mollusk dies, its shell is subject to deterioration resulting from attack by a great variety of boring organisms, including worms, sponges, other mollusks, and algae. Most sea bottoms on which living shelled organisms are abundant have surprisingly few empty shells. And here's an example of some that a friend of mine from Hood River, Oregon, gave me. Some of these are clams, some brachiopods, some oysters. But notice, they're closed shells. And this is the way it is all over there. What is this telling us? It's telling us they had to be buried rapidly. So rapidly that they never had a chance to even open up. Again, powerful evidence for Noah's flood from fossils. And we have these interesting fossils right here. They're called polystrate fossils. Sometimes it can be a whale skeleton, but a lot of times it's a tree, where a tree goes through many strata. Poly means many, strat means stratum. So we have these trees. In fact, this is not an isolated incident. A lot of times you find them in coal mines, such things. I have verified them in Alaska. But they go through many layers. And the mainstream geologists say each of these layers, if they're thick layers, they maybe took 300,000 years to deposit. You know, sometimes their deposition rate's about 1 centimeter per 1,000 years. Well, if that is the case, that log there would rot before it even got started. And yet there's the decay is the same at the top as the bottom, indicating that all this strata here was deposited rapidly. And these are not isolated examples. Now, what do the mainstream geologists say about it? Oh, they say it was just local rapid deposition. Well, then I ask them to prove it. I mean, this looks like any strata you see anywhere else. There's no special indication that it was deposited rapidly. But since it's similar to a strata all over, it's more indication that it was deposited rapidly. Okay, my last is evidence from Mount St. Helens. Of course, many of you are very familiar with this example, beautiful Mount St. Helens. I'm a backpacker. I've backpacked all through the Cascade Mountains. I used to backpack north of Mount St. Helens. I don't do that anymore, of course. And in 1980, it blew its top. The northern part of it blew off. And we learned at Mount St. Helens, just that little volcano. By the way, this is a little volcano compared to big volcanoes. Even in historical time, we've had much larger. Tambora in 1815 was much larger than Mount St. Helens. Krakatoa in 1893. But what we learned from Mount St. Helens is that a number of lessons. I mean, these are lessons that us creationists know, but these are lessons that a lot of other people learned kind of by accident. First of all, it quickly formed stratification, layers. They said, well, why should all these layers you see in a cliff, why it seems like they'd form slowly. I think the millions of years are in the layers. No, you could form layers rapidly. And Mount St. Helens showed that you can do this. Also, in the rapidly eroded canyons, sometimes in one day canyons were formed 100 feet deep. And it blew down so many logs, and a wave on Spirit Lake came up 800 feet up the other side and washed about a million of those logs back into Spirit Lake. And so they were floating. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But it deposited upright logs on the bottom of Spirit Lake. It rapidly formed what's called a peat layer. Peat is kind of the first step in the formation of coal. It's a debris laid on the bottom of a lake that doesn't get oxygen, and it just forms organic matter that's very porous. Also formed a badland topography rapidly. Also, as the debris flows from the volcano were going down the Toodle River at high speeds, they scratched the bottom of the bedrock, forming what looks like glacial striations, mimicking what is considered one of three diagnostic properties for an ancient glaciation or any glaciation, that is striations on bedrock or grooving. So we know that landslides can duplicate what looks like a glacial feature by sliding over solid rocks. Also, it formed very thin layers or laminae, which a lot of times you find this in the rock record. They say that's a year's worth of deposition, that thin millimeter thick layer called a var. But thin layers were formed rapidly. Actually, they were formed while the pyroclastic flow was going 100 miles an hour down from Mount St. Helens. This really shocked them. Here's a canyon formed. I think this is formed over a month or two. It's Engineers Canyon. As they were draining, Spirit Lake was getting up there, afraid that was going to break through and cause a huge flash flood down the Toodle River. So they bled out the water, and within a short time, this canyon was formed. And of course, that's what I used to hike in around Mount St. Helens. And this is what it looked like after the blast. Over, 300 square miles? And then a lot of the logs ended up back in, about a million of them back in Spirit Lake. And a good amount of them, they estimate maybe 20,000 have sunk to the bottom. And as Spirit Lake, as sediments are forming on Spirit Lake, the logs are sinking. And therefore, the logs that are vertical are at a different level, which explains a major challenge to flood geology, and that's in Yellowstone Park. We have what's called these petrified vertical trees. They call them, and they're in layers, one after another. I guide people to these sites, by the way. I've seen them many times. But there's a lot of horizontal trees. They call them the fossil forest. How many have seen these? Maybe about 20, 25 of you. Good. Anyway, with Mount St. Helens, we can explain this. This example, when it was brought to the public earlier in the 20th century, many Christians supposedly lost their faith over this. Said the flood can't explain that. Well, the flood really can, because the flood is going to rip up logs and vegetation, and it's going to be floating on the floodwaters. Trillions of logs are going to be floating around the earth, and a lot of them are going to end up sinking vertically. And in this area, it must have stalled towards the end of the flood. And this is landslide material, by the way. One landslide after another, and these logs are in that material. There's no soils. There is no soils in there. There are organic layers, but the decay is the same at the top and the bottom. No decay. In fact, you find lots of leaf fossils and needle fossils. And another thing is that when you look at the pollen and the trees in this, you find that they come from 200 different trees, different species of trees, ranging from tropical trees to cool temperate trees. So what are they doing in one spot? Obviously, this is not a forest. We have lots of evidence that this was deposited during the log mat, when there's a log mat floating on the floodwaters, as I was explaining earlier, and the logs were sinking vertically, while the bottom was forming sediments rapidly. Anyway, we have a good model to explain it. And yet they have lots of contradictions in their model when you look at this example in detail. As I show people on the spot, usually once a year or once every other year. Okay, the question is, if there's so much evidence for the flood, and like I said, this is not hidden in a corner. This is the fossils themselves and the strata, the sedimentary rocks. Why can't mainstream scientists see all this evidence for the flood? You know, if it's so powerful. Well, you know, it's not that simple. This whole area is not about evidence. It's a worldview issue. If you want to look at the history, read the history of the Enlightenment, where they just arbitrarily in the 1700s decided, we don't want the Bible anymore. So they threw the Bible out and said, we're going to explain everything just with pure human reason. And then they looked around, and I'm being metaphorical here, looked around and said, we got all these sedimentary rocks and we got all these bones in it. How did they happen without the flood? See, they used to correctly believe the flood did it. Well, it has to come about all by itself. But how? Oh, we only have present processes that we see today to explain it. So that's how it happened. And then the earth becomes old overnight. Not because of evidence, because they arbitrarily chose to throw out the Bible and explain everything by present processes over millions of years. So the millions of years are suddenly there, and the flood is thrown out. But still, why can't they see this evidence? I was a rotating shift worker for 30 years, I was very interested in sleep research. So I bought this book, The Promise of Sleep. And just by accident, I came across this great quote. He was a sleep researcher from Stanford University. He says, when they are looking, people usually see only what they expect to find, and they do not see what they assume, for whatever reason, could not exist. They believe there is no chance for a global flood. Therefore, it's out of their mind, out of sight, out of mind. That's why they can't see it. It's a psychological thing. It's like the Lake Missoula flood. The J. Harlan Bretz first taught science at Franklin High School here, and went on to get more education, but noticed in eastern Washington when the maps were there, you saw these dry waterfalls, 400 feet tall, dry falls, the potholes, and he saw these channels, huge channels, and said, that looks like a monstrous flood out there. So he went out there and spent the next, since 1923 to about 1933, researching this, and said, we had a huge monstrous flood out there. I mean, the evidence, when you go out there and you know something about it, there are hundreds of pieces of evidence that he's right. Great piece of detective work. But it was rejected for 40 years. And why? Because it was too big, too biblical. They said, we don't believe in big floods anymore. We only believe in little floods. So as a result, they retarded science for 40 years. And I believe that's the same thing today, is that there's tons of evidence for the global flood out there, but they will not see it. It's because of their mindset. In summary, flood traditions from all over the world indicate a global flood. Mount St. Helens indicates that geological events can happen rapidly. You can form those strata, 600 feet of strata, quickly in this case. So you don't need millions of years to form thick layers of sedimentary rock. Sedimentary rocks are commonly regional, sometimes on a continental scale, much greater than present processes could possibly do. And between layers, there's no or very little erosion between the strata, indicating they're deposited rapidly, one after another. For fossils, organisms must be buried rapidly, and the flood is a great mechanism to bury organisms rapidly. Chemicals must be absorbed rapidly. The flood is a great mechanism for that. As you bury these organisms rapidly, thousands of feet of sediments, they're wet sediments. They're full of chemicals. And you're pressing down on them, and under high pressure, the chemicals are moving horizontally. The water and the chemicals, they're moving through the sediment and the organisms. And they'll cement the rocks rapidly, and they'll fossilize rapidly. There are billions of fossils, while fossilization is a very rare event today. And what do you expect in a flood? What kind of evidence? Well, you'd expect billions of dead things buried in rock layers all over the earth. That's exactly what we see out there, if not trillions of them. And many fossils are found in huge graveyards, implying very catastrophic action, just like you'd expect during the flood. And mollusks are mostly closed-shelled all over the earth, indicating worldwide rapid burial. Whoops, looks like my PowerPoint. Didn't get it all, but anyway, if you want to know more about this, there's a number of geology books back there, and one's called The Geology Book. It's for young people and adults. It's by John Morris. Also, if you want to know more about Mount St. Helens, there's Footprints in Ash by Dr. John Morris and Dr. Steve Austin. And I am in the business of dealing with flood challenges, so I asked about 10 scientists to summarize their research. So I edited this with John Reed. I call it Rock Solid Answers. It deals with 14 challenges that they give us to the flood, like reefs. Well, how do we handle reefs, not only during the flood, but after? Well, they're not quite reefs during the flood, as you would find out. But anyway, that's a book if you want to learn more about geology. We're doing a national park series. See, when you go to national parks, there's lots of propaganda. Millions of years, evolution. I mean, so what we're doing, we're going to the national parks, and in brilliant color, these are better guides than the secular guides. There's a team of four of us now that is going around. We've done Grand Canyon, Zion and Bryce. We're finishing up Yellowstone, Grand Teton, and we just did Yosemite, Sequoia, and Kings Canyon. But you can get this either if they don't have them in the bookstore here, you can get them online.